silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask those present to please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. Remember, the person next to you may actually be listening. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And we've just started the trip through the steps again last week with step one, part A, and we're going to do part B of step one tonight. Next week you come back, we'll be on step two. So we always like to say before we start that we're not sitting up here as experts on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not here to teach. We're just here to share experience, strength, and hope on the process of recovery in the hopes that it might help some other people. Did we decide I was going to go
You're
first?
You're kicking it off.
All right. I'm going to talk you to death for a little. So we're going to kick off tonight on page 51. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business.
Page 5.
We're in Bill's story, page 5. Sometimes when you see the closed parentheses, it looks like a 1. Hey, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed to be near just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone, and in no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. So you know, we're talking about step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And, you know, the short version of my story is I got sober when I was 28. My first AA meeting, I was 22 years old. And you guys presented me with this idea that I was powerless over alcohol. And that seemed to imply that it wasn't up to me. And I rejected that summarily. That surely I can figure this out, a smart guy like me. But you guys planted that seed, David, that simple idea that if you're an alcoholic, once you start, you can't stop because of the physical allergy. Once you put it in you, we talked about that last week. This craving develops that won't be satisfied. But then the fun starts when we start trying to stop. When I put the plug in the jug, renew my resolve. I ain't drinking anymore. And I don't know about anybody else. I know a lot of people who say they never tried to stop drinking. Well, I tried to stop drinking many, many times. It was a darn fine idea for me to stop drinking when I was in high school. And I stopped drinking in high school. I had dropped out of high school, actually, in the 10th grade. I spent my day, I'd sleep till noon, I'd take large packages and divide them down into smaller packages. And then I would sell those to my friends and make a profit and keep some of the package material for myself. And then I would go out at night and work. I worked in a, in the kitchen at a bar. And so I would eat and I would drink and I would stay out until about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning with my friends, sleep till noon, get up and do it again. So that was where high school was going. And I realized that I wasn't going to graduate. I wasn't going to get the goodies. I wasn't going to have a job. I wasn't going to be, you know, people ask me what I want to do with my life. I'm like, I'm good. And so I stopped drinking for about 30 days in earnest. I stopped drinking completely and found out I could go to class, doubled up on my classes. I made honor roll. I graduated on time. I did all that stuff. So there was a period of time there where my resolve would work. I could make up my mind to do something and it would work for a small period of time. The clock's always ticking. Someone had pushed a drink my way. No recovery, no AA. I don't want to go to AA. I don't want any recovery. I don't want to, you know, I got this thing. I'll handle this thing. I'll find a way to have my cake and eat it too. Another time in the last year of my drinking, I had sobered up for a girl this time. And that's a good reason to sober up. And so I was about 60 days abstinent, no AA, no nothing. And I went down to, I was getting on a plane to go visit my father. And I was going to join my brother, my two greatest drinking buddies, my father and my brother. We're going to go on a fishing trip down in Florida. And I had every intention of not drinking on that trip. I hadn't been drinking for 60 days. Baby, I'm good. I'm going to go down, hang out with my brother, my dad. I'm not drinking. And I really believed it, and I really meant it. I really had decided not to drink. I didn't have it in the back of my mind. Nothing. I had booked myself a flight out of Norfolk, connecting out of Charlotte down to Fort Lauderdale, and I changed planes in Charlotte. And I went on to my brother, who was coming from D.C. just for the hell of it, found out what my flight was, booked himself a seat next to me, and when I came in and I sat down, there was a double Jack on the rocks waiting for me, because my brother is a kind and considerate person like that. And I sat down, and with no more thought than that, I was like, well, thank you. And it would be rude not to accept that. And as the whiskey rose to my head, I decided, well, you know what? I'm going down fishing with my brother and my father. It'd be silly to try to stay sober on this adventure. So I stayed drunk for about 10 days with those guys. Had a blast. Just had a super good time. And then on the way home, I remember making the decision that I was never going to try to stay sober again, ever. I remember making the decision on the plane. I was like, I don't care if I live another 5 days or another 55 years, but I'm going to stay drunk the whole time. And I didn't quite make it, but but I tried. Laura?
Hey, everybody. I'm Laura, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Laura.
I'm thinking about the second part of step one was talking about, and that our lives had become unmanageable. For me, I think I knew that alcohol was a big, huge, important part of my life, and also that it was causing me a lot of trouble from a pretty young age. In high school, I started drinking Tried it in seventh grade, a little bit more in eighth grade. By the summer before high school, I was doing it anytime I can get my hands on it, stealing it from the babysitters, you know, stuff like that. And I think about like how unmanageable my life was becoming, unmanageable even at that point. Like just the lengths that I would go to, you know, lying and stealing and the lengths, sneaking out of the house, stealing the parents' car, to be at a place where I could get access to alcohol. And the reason why that was so important for me at the time was I discovered when I started drinking what it did for me, and the feeling of it was like a magic pill to make all the anxiety and like awkwardness, my fears go away. And suddenly, where I felt like when I was sober I didn't fit in anywhere, I felt cool and I felt like I can fit in with people that I looked up to, people that I thought were what I perceived to be as cool at the time. But my life was already becoming unmanageable because I wasn't one of those, although I thought that I was really good at lying and stealing and sneaking out and stuff like that, I always got caught. Always. And then I would have to deal with the consequences of getting caught, and, you know, from being grounded permanently to, you know, I would get pulled over by the police, getting in trouble at school, getting kicked out of school, being put on probation, having to have your analysis on a regular basis as a teenager, you know, having to go to after patient therapy sessions and like just all these things at a very young age. That's what my life looked like. And it was very unmanageable. And then just getting to the point, finally, I remember the first time I tried to stop drinking, I was 16, and it was because I was forced. Either it was like, go to AA meetings or you're on house arrest and you get no life. So I chose to go to AA meetings. And that was my first kind of dose of what you guys had to offer me. But I wasn't ready yet. I wasn't taking it serious. I wasn't getting sober for the right reasons. I was being forced to do it. And I still at that time thought I had time. I thought that I was just doing what everybody else was doing my age, and eventually I would sober up and get my act together. What I didn't know at the time was it was already too late for me. I had already set off the cycle of alcoholism. And it was beyond my mental control even at that young age. So, you know, I had to go back out and get some more drinking experience and get some more bumps and bruises, literally, and some more charges. I'm one of those drunks that just, I'm really sloppy and I get in a lot of trouble. So my life was screaming at me that this is totally unmanageable. Like, stop. Why do you keep doing this? And I would wake up in a jail cell the next day and like telling my parents, oh my God, I'm sorry, it happened again, and going to court and leaving court and getting off kind of easy and saying, I'm never going to do this again. God, I'm never going to do this again. I'm never going to court again. And then within the next year, I was going to court again for something else. And I too had this thought, was I crazy? I didn't want to say like alcohol was my problem. Like that just seemed too easy. And it was too easy because alcohol is just a symptom of my problem, and I didn't know that until, you know, actually like 5 years ago. Alcohol is just a symptom of my problem, but I can't pick it up because once I do, it sets off the cycle and my life just spins totally out of control again. You know, but I still struggled with the whole self-will thing and thinking like after getting arrested for my second DUI, journaling to myself, you know you're an alcoholic. Do not forget these words. You know you cannot safely take a drink because you cannot predict, you know, what's going to happen once you start drinking. I told myself, I had this like little diary, you're a liar, you're a cheat, you're a thief, you're a bad daughter, you're a bad sister. And I knew all these things about how my behavior was. And I was gonna muster up the self-will and just stay away from it. And so I get out of jail, and what do I start doing? I start thinking like, well, I don't have to change all of my life. I'm just not going to drink, right? Like, that should be pretty easy. I've been off of it for a week now. I was in jail for a week. And so I start hanging out with my same people, you know? And it's not, you know, I'm sorry if this insults anybody. I hate the whole people, places, and things because it's not their fault. You know, I can be anywhere. It talks about in our book, you know, send me to freaking, like, Alaska, or not Alaska, what is it?
Polarized.
Whatever. Greenland. The North Pole, and I'll find some excuse to drink if it's there. But, you know, that's what I did. I hung out with the same people, and I was their designated driver, and I had something to prove to myself. I was trying to prove to myself that I could beat drinking on my own. Therefore, that would make me non-alcoholic. And I mustered up about 3 months on my own self-will before what happens is I got the mental twist that convinced me that, you know what, you've been doing such a great job staying sober on your own for 3 months. You can't be an alcoholic. If I was an alcoholic, there's no way in hell I could be around all this temptation and, like, turn down drinks and still have a good time. And so I decided if I just switch my friends and hang out with healthier drinkers that have jobs and go to school and do well and function, that perhaps I can mimic their drinking behavior, you know. And so, like, at that point, I still had not given up the idea that the whole control, like, this substance has more power over me than I ever will have over it, whether it's in me or not. And I thought that as long as I didn't put it in me, I had power over it, and I was wrong. But I still hadn't fully gotten to a step one yet at that point, and so I had more drinking to do.
So we'll pick up on page 7, not 71, 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn in alcoholics the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. Though it remains strong in other respects, my incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. I just kind of noticed this, like, all these things that we deploy, they all have self in them, you know? Self-will, self-knowledge, self-control, you know? And when I think of self-knowledge, I think about my friend Eric, who always says, you know, all my self-help books have highball rings around them. And I had the same. I had a whole stack of, like, how to heal your life, you know, 1 minute meditations, free at last, all this kind of stuff. You know, I mean, I would come home with bags of books from Barnes and Noble, and I think there's a closet somewhere. There's still probably bags of books that are unopened, because I loved that feeling. It gave me hope to browse the aisles and look at the titles and stuff, and think, wow, when I read this, you know, then I'm going to know something, and it's going to be all right. My whole life's going to change. So this self-knowledge, if I could just, you know, so I go to the psychiatrist. I sent my girlfriend to the psychiatrist. She went. But I really was operating under this kind of delusion that, because really what's going on, looking back on it, I don't know if I knew it at the time. I'm sure I had an inkling. But what I really want to do is not entertain the idea of not drinking anymore. I want to protect that as an option. I'm going to be able to have drinking as an option. So I always had this idea, like, if I could just find this hidden spring of my mind, this just piece of information that I could get it from the psychiatrist or a book or something, then I would understand myself and I'd be able to probably drink like a gentleman, you know, or just at least catch a buzz every once in a while and weird stuff wouldn't happen, you know, the violent stuff wouldn't happen, the disgusting stuff, the dangerous stuff, the twisted stuff wouldn't happen. So self-knowledge is one of those things that I just relate to and in the ways that I tried to fix myself. And the way that you guys kept putting it to me very simply when I came here was, David, if you're an alcoholic, you got a problem that you can't solve. That was all the man said to me. And I was like, yeah, maybe you can't. You know, I can't. I'll figure it out. So I've got a problem that I can't solve. I don't really know what's wrong with me. You know, I don't really understand that once I start, I can't stop. And when I stop, the clock's just ticking for me to have another one. And I'm just going to continue to try to figure it out. Just do what I've always done. So I'm one of the people who had to drink with the information. I had to keep coming here, and you guys kept telling me what was wrong with me. I kept telling you it wasn't true, and I'd go out and try it one more time.
It was funny. I was in a ASAP class, which for those of you who've had DUIs know what that is, but it's where the courts will send you once you have a DUI. If you want to get your license back, you have to go to these aftercare educational classes. And it was funny, I was 4 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I was even eligible to get my license back, and then I had to go to ASAP with all these other people pretending to be sober and like listening to them, you know, describe alcoholism to me. And it was funny because I was in this room with a bunch of drunks that were saying that, you know, the problem with those damn alcoholics, they just have no willpower. And I was like, ah, you know, and I was thinking about this particular paragraph, and I was like, no, we have willpower, a lot of it, and everything else, but concerning alcohol. Which explains how stubborn I am in all areas of my life, you know. And I'm one of those people who, you know, I love to know things and feel like I'm, you know, I have all this knowledge, and I'll sit there and I'll listen to you. If I respect you, I'll sit there, I'll listen to you, I'll nod, I'll be like, yeah, I totally get that. You're so right. And then I walk out the door, and then I have something happen, I perceive it, I feel something, and then I, boom, I react. And it doesn't have anything to do with everything that I just said. Yeah, that totally makes sense, and that's the right thing to do. I'm going to go and do and react something completely different. And that's how I live my entire life, is based on my perception and my feeling. And it's caused me a lot of trouble and a lot of pain. You know, so, and it's funny when it's talking to her, you know, understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. You know, I had all this therapy and like even doing inventory, for crying out loud. I do inventory and write and like dissect myself and peel back the layers of the onion, you know, to get to the truth of why I am the way I am. And I see it, and then I do the same thing over and over and over again. And it's just so funny because like none of that there's something huge missing from that portion of like self-discovery and like self-knowledge. And it's the whole idea that I cannot heal myself with my sick mind. My main problem centers in my mind. And if I'm trying to think myself into right action, it's not going to work for me. And so that's where the whole, I mean, we're not on step two yet, but for me, if I'm not like trying to tap into something bigger than me that can get into this crazy brain of mine and help me with my thinking, I'm doomed. I'm gonna drink again eventually or do something to hurt myself. And I'm gonna continue to make same mistakes over and over again, wondering why my life looks so crappy all the time. Because I try to continuously insert self into all areas of my life. And I mean, I just shared previously that I ended up, you know, all this self-knowledge I had to keep me sober, and it never stuck. Nothing ever stuck. Even 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, putting the checks in the box, oh, step one, step two, step three, all the way down. And I missed something really, really huge the first time around. I missed the fact that I really wasn't the one doing this. I took credit for everything, my entire sobriety. Look at this meeting I started. Look at this, you know. It was all about me. I hadn't learned anything about spiritual principles and practicing that behind, you know, I'd go and I'd do a power share and I'd come back home and live my life, you know, in the dark, like doing things that I knew that were probably bad for me, but I didn't care because it made me feel good. And my making actions based on what was going to make me feel good right then and right there, I might as well have been drinking. Because that's exactly what alcohol does for me. I don't feel good, I'm going to drink. Take that away. Or I feel, I'm kind of bored right now, I'm going to drink, they'll take it away. Or I'm freaking excited, hey, I'm going to drink, make it even better. You know, I do that with other behaviors in my life. Now that I'm not drinking, I can't use that. I'll find something else. I'll find a man to use, or I'll go shopping, or I'll use like other people and like gossip, you know, all that kind of stuff. Anything to make me feel better about myself and my intolerable situation that I created. And that was a big problem for me too, is I like to blame everybody else for my circumstances. And I get here and I'm told that I have to start cleaning up my mess. And not just clean up the past, but continue today and move forward and try to aim for better behavior so that I don't pick up that drink again.
All right. We're going to continue on page 24. Squiggly writing. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow even a glass of beer don't crowd into the mind to deter us. And if these thoughts do occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Yeah, I mean, I am strangely insane when it comes to alcohol, because today, today I really believe I know what it's going to look like if I on the way home tonight go grab a six pack on the way home. And it might take a couple of days for that to develop, or a couple of weeks, or a couple of months, I don't really know. But I know today that in a very short period of time, it's going to be just as bad, just as weird as it ever was, if not worse. I understand that. So if I understand that, then it would be insane to actually choose that, you know, just like the hot stove, you know. And we talk about the allergy, you know, if you eat a strawberry and your throat closes and you go into anaphylactic shock and they got to have an EpiPen or you're going to die, you just say, well, you know, and I think I'll just not have any strawberries anymore. And are there strawberries in that? Because I react really badly when I have strawberries. Oh, there are? I'll avoid that. And you don't have to go to a 12-step program to do that. It's like, you know, you're not sitting around going, well, what if I just had strawberries on the weekends? Maybe it's the strawberries from Norfolk that are a problem. You know, maybe the South American strawberries would work better. Perhaps a milkshake of strawberry. You know, I mean, that's clearly that's insane, right? But with alcohol, I don't see that. I know exactly what it's going to look like and how violent and how disturbing it's going to be. As I don't care when I'm loaded. I really don't care. I'll chuck my whole life. Fuck it. Don't you have a job and a family, David? Ah, we're going to Texas. Fuck it. You know, that's the way I like to drink. So I'm unable at certain times to bring into my mind. The old threadbare idea for me, and the one that I just replayed over and over again, is this time it'll be different. This time it'll be different. And I could talk myself into that somehow, some way. You know, I'm just going to, I can see where tequila is a problem. That's got to go, you know. And I can see how I'm not going to get my career goals together, smoking crack. And I quit before they called it crack. We used to call it freebase, but that's a whole other thing. But so I tried to move the pieces around, and I can remember saying, "No more draft beer." When I go out, I can't. I used to drink at this place where they had 80-cent pitchers, and so you could just basically go in with a dollar or two, and even you could just go in, if you didn't have a dollar or two, you'd go in and get a glass, because everybody in there knows you, and they're drinking out of, hey, you know, I'm light. And I remember thinking, I'll just drink Budweiser out of the bottle. If I just stay with Budweiser, because I saw a guy. I was like, how come you're not drinking the pitchers? He goes, I drink too much when I drink the pitchers. I just drink these bottles. And I thought, that guy's a genius. That's the smartest thing I've ever heard in my life. I want a bottle. And so I've tried that, you know. I've tried just drinking on Friday nights, you know. I'll just get my paycheck. I'll just go blow the tubes out once a week, you know, and that's it. And then the rest of the weekend, I'll be a good boy, tend the garden, try to muster up the give a shit about the lawn, you know, that all this stuff I don't care about. I've told you before, I would like to be a guy who cares about the lawn. I really think I should be a guy who cares about the lawn. It kind of galls me that I can give a rat's ass about the lawn. I do not care about it. I don't care if it's trimmed. I just don't care about it. But I think I should. And then I think if I stop drinking, then I will care about the lawn. But I digress. So the weekend drinking experiment, what that looks like is you start on Friday night, and that goes so well, you can have a few on Saturday, right? And eventually, weekend drinking, what that looked like for me was it starts on Thursday evening and finishes somewhere around Wednesday. You know, because you got to take the edge off. And then once I start, the whole cycle continues and continues. And it doesn't look like that before I take that first drink. To me, it looks like it's going to be different this time. I'm going to handle myself better. I really am going to go have a couple, and then I'm going to go home. I'm not going to say anything obnoxious. I'm not going to get my ass kicked tonight. I fancy myself a fighter. I'm really more of a bleeder. I've been face down in a parking lot, you know, before, thinking he's going to get tired of kicking me in the ribs soon. I can outlast him on the ground. I was convinced my last words on the planet were going to be, I was just kidding you, man. Because what it looks like to me, man, is I'm just a guy who wants to be another guy. You know, I work with these guys. Look at them. They go out on Friday night. They have a couple of beers. You know, what's wrong with that? I'm over 21. I'm bringing the money home. You know, I'm paying my taxes. How come a guy like me can't have a drink? And I pull up a chair to that, you know? I mean, there's one guy in there that goes, yeah, you know what happens when we drink, David. I'm like, why don't you shut up? Get that guy a drink. So all I really believe that this means, this powerless over alcohol means, that I am condemned to repeat this cycle unless there's some intervention, this spiritual experience, this psychic change, you know, that we call it. Unless this happens for me, then the clock really is ticking for me to have another drink, no matter what time of day it is or how many years I've been sober. Weeks, months, doesn't matter. Fortunately, we have a solution here.
So at this point, I love this paragraph, and it's italicized for a reason. And this is one of the things that I fought for a really long time, is this idea that I choose to pick up a drink, and I can choose to put it down. And you hear people in meetings say, and I was guilty of this, fresh out of rehab, raising my hand and sharing and saying, you know, today, I choose not to pick up a drink. And I thought that I knew, you know, what that meant, that it made perfect sense, and, you know, it sounded good and frothy. you know, and then I had a sponsor that read this with me and explained, and she started sharing with me her experiences of why she had evidence that said, no, I don't have a choice of whether I pick up this drink or not. I'm always going to pick it up. And there's, you know, there's been people who've given me really friendly and cute advice, like play the tape forward before you pick up the drink. And that makes sense, right, to a normal person. And then I started thinking about that, and I was looking at what our literature is telling us, and I'm like, wait a second. If my main problem centers in my mind, I have a sick mind, I can't trust the thoughts that I have that give me the advice to myself about drinking and everything else, and yet I'm going to tell myself that play the tape forward, think about the consequences that are going to happen to you if you pick up a drink, right? Well, that works for me when it works, but what about the nights and the days that it doesn't work, when it exactly this happens to me? I am unable at certain times to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and the humiliation that I suffered, even a week ago. That happened to me. I had 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous doing this thing, going through the steps, starting meetings, look at me, and this happened to me. I knew I was an alcoholic, but suddenly in that moment, I said, well, what if I'm not? And that's where it began. And because I had stopped doing the work, this work, and I had successfully detached myself from all of you, it was very easy for me to start plotting and scheming and praying, God, please let me not be an alcoholic. And I took the experiment of the first drink again, thinking, praying, hoping that all my self-knowledge and Alcoholics Anonymous and my 5 years abstinent of alcohol and getting all the things back in my life and having a job and having a car and having a license and not being on probation and paying my bills, that I had earned the right to drink like a normal person. And God, I wanted to be able to do that. But what was crazy is that maybe 2 years prior to that moment, I couldn't even imagine ever drinking again because I was so happy. I was so happy with sobriety. And 2 years later, I was so sick and I hated the way I felt sober. And my solution at that time was to try drinking again to see if that would give me the ease and comfort that I was searching for. And I had forgotten that I was supposed to be searching it in a spiritual solution. But because I kept making decisions based on self, decisions on if I choose this relationship, although it might not be good for me and it's probably really toxic and abusive, but I can fix that. And I at least won't have to be alone. And at least he loves me. I can manage this. And suddenly, everything that I knew just got shifted, there was no God. I was God. He was God. And I was willing to go to any lengths for that kind of ease and comfort, not for ease and comfort of a spiritual solution. And I threw away the 5 years of sobriety. I gave it away. I don't even know how I made it back because I distinctly remember saying, it's not as bad as it was. It's not as bad as it was. I haven't been arrested yet. I don't know if I can really concede to my innermost self that I believe I'm an alcoholic right now. Things are starting to get a little crazy. But I didn't feel it yet. And I was like, I can't go back to AA unless I believe I can raise my hand and say without a shadow of a doubt, my name is Laura, and I'm an alcoholic, and I fought that, and I seriously believe that I had just one moment of like divine inspiration where this individual that I drank for said, "If you don't get sober, I'm going to be visiting you in a jail cell," and I know it, and for some reason it hit, and I was like, "Oh my God, that's exactly what's going to happen to me." And I'm going to lose the job, and I'm going to lose everything, and I'm going to have another felony charge for drinking and driving. And I had a moment of clarity where I said, I better get back before it's too late. And I did. And I just, man, people just don't know, like, even myself, like, all the pain and suffering I went through the first round trying to get here to Alcoholics Anonymous didn't even hold a candle to the pain and suffering that I went trying to keep my ass back here the second time around. And it's like Russian roulette with my life and the decisions. I know we all have different stories, but you know, being in a relationship with somebody who was also an alcoholic and trying desperately to find the will to live and trying to deal with that on top of getting sober myself and thinking like this is a fucking game. Pulling guns out of his hands and putting my life in jeopardy and trying to stay sober all at the same time. That's nobody's job. My job is for me to stay sober and take care of myself. And thinking like I have the power to get anybody else sober is just crazy. And people just, we don't even know. We just think that we have so much time left to get this. And we all don't get second chances or third chances or fourth chances. People take their lives and don't ever come back. Thanks.
So we're going to pick up on page 34. For those who are unable to drink moderately, who wants to drink moderately anyway? Sorry. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming, of course, the reader desires to stop. It's a good point to check. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or wish. That's the last year of my drinking began on that plane in December of 1988, where I decided I'm never going to drink anymore. I mean, I'm never going to try to be sober anymore. I'm not going to draw another sober breath for the rest of my life. I made it to the end of February of 89. And I was, I got my one and only DUI. I spent my 6 hours in the drunk tank. That's the extent of my legal trouble. I had more legal trouble as a juvenile than I did as an adult. But I had not intended to go to Fairfax, Virginia, when I woke up that morning. Freak snowstorm happened in Norfolk. I didn't have to work. So I made chili. You know what making chili is, right? You fill the entire refrigerator full of beer and fuss over the chili pot all day long. I have a vague recollection of my friends telling me it's probably not a good idea for you to drive to Northern Virginia right now, David. And I have a vague recollection of stopping in Williamsburg and calling my cousin in Fredericksburg. A vague recollection of closing that bar in Fredericksburg on my way to Fairfax. I have a little Polaroid snapshot of him getting out of the car going, "Don't drive through Old Town Fairfax." Wah! There's a section of 123 that's serpentine and hilly and everything. I was just straightening it out, you know. And the nice man, you know, the blue lights came and the nice man came and I was very polite to him. You know, I'd had enough where the question, "Have you been drinking, sir?" I was like, "You bet." I didn't even try to BS him. I was just like, "Yep, I'm hammered. What took you so long?" You know, one of those deals where you open the car door and the beer cans spill out, you know? It's like, "Ah, you got me." So I remember standing out in the cruel morning light on that February morning on 123 across from a law office that my grandfather had started. He was like the 17th attorney in the city of Fairfax. He was respected in the community there. Everybody knew his name, and I never knew him. He died when I was young, but I was just standing there and getting that first cigarette in and trying to keep down that cold sausage and warm orange juice that they gave me that morning, and just thinking, "God, man, you know, this is just, I'm going to be dead before I'm 30. You know, this is bullshit. You know, this is bullshit. I can't keep doing this." My cousin pulls up in a Cadillac and goes, "Hey, come on, I know where we can get Budweiser for breakfast." Got in the car, closed the door. I was like, "Whew, I don't know what I was thinking a minute ago." I was hammered by lunch again, you know, and I came back. I came to AA again, and because I thought it would look good on the when I went to court later on in the summer. I was going to go to AA and get the cure, get good, you know, and I ran into some people that knew what was really wrong with me and didn't really want to hear anything I had to say, which pissed me off because I had a lot to say, you know. They'd cut me off in the middle. "Yeah, yeah, we know. Why don't you go over there and get that coffee pot, David?" I was like, well, see, why don't you go talk to that guy who just came in? Like, I don't want to talk to that guy, man. I don't know that guy. Just go talk to him. And I ran with those guys for about 90 days, and they showed me AA. They said, you know, you're going to go to the meetings that I go to. We go to about 7 a week, and we're going to go early, and we're going to help set up. We're going to stay late, and we're going to look for some people that we can help. You know, it's not all about you anymore, David. Come on, let's go. And they showed me AA, and I just went along. Well, I was 28 years old. I healed up pretty quick. So after about 90 days, I started feeling pretty good, you know? And I started thinking less and less of the people that I was running around with. You know, they weren't very bright, for starters. Not very smart guys. Not like me. And they seemed to be stupidly happy, you know? And for no good reason, you know? And I don't know. They said something I didn't want. Well, exactly what happened was I called my sponsor and I said, I'm not coming to home group tonight. There's a concert down in North Carolina I'm gonna go down and go to. And he said, well, as far as I'm concerned, that's your home group and you'll be there. Click. And I was like, well, that's it for AA. I never did have another drink. But I started another program called David's Anonymous. And in David's Anonymous, you're allowed to do recreational hallucinogens, benzodiazepines if you have a little trouble sleeping or you have a little anxiety, you know, just occasionally, whenever, you know, you consult yourself and you feel like it's warranted. And so I spent 6 months going to that program. And that was what led me to that final just surrender. Because what was happening with me was that I desperately did not want to drink anymore. I really had given up the idea that it was going to be any different. That had been, you guys planted the seed when I was 22, and then I lived it out. You know, I just kept trying to move the pieces around, and I just couldn't. Just couldn't. And I knew if I started, I didn't know what, you know, I didn't know where it was going to go from there. If it was going to be another 10 years, and I didn't want to live like that anymore. Desperately did not want to drink anymore. A desperate desire to stop. And exactly parallel to that intense desire to stop was an absolute, convinced, deep down in my gut, knowing that I'm about to get drunk. I know what it feels like to be about to get drunk. And I'm just waiting for you to look at me just a little funny. Or a shoelace to break, or, you know, something. You know, I would drive around, and my meditations were things like, you know, if my mom died, would that be a good enough reason to drink? You know, I believe I could go on a good bender if my mom died. You know, I think everybody would understand that. You know, and then by the end of the week, I'm thinking, is that old bitch still alive? You know, and then you don't feel too good about yourself when you have thoughts like that. You know, wishing your own mother dead so you could go have a toot. You know, So I got this desperate desire to stop and this absolute knowing that I'm going to get drunk again and I don't want to get drunk anymore. So I run that through the computer up here, this magnificent, all omnipotent, I'm my go-to guy, I'm my consultant. I don't need to talk to anybody, I don't need any advice. And the answer came back, just kill yourself. Just jump. Jump off a building. And I had selected the Baton Arts and Letters building, a 7-story building at Old Dominion. That was the scene of my first failure in Norfolk after I came here on my one and only geographic, moved from Arlington to Norfolk, and to go back to college because everything was going to be different this time. So I thought that would be poetic to just splat, you know, from there. And I couldn't do it, you know, for a lot of reasons. I don't think I ever really lost all hope. I know for sure I'm a complete coward, and I don't have any tattoos because I'm terribly afraid of commitment of any kind. So I never really gave up the idea that maybe that would be a permanent solution to what was perhaps a temporary problem, you know. But that was the condition I was in. I desperately wanted to get drunk. I desperately did not want to drink anymore, and I'm absolutely thinking about killing myself, and I thought, I'll go back to AA one more time. One more time. And that was it. I just walked into a room just like this one, just like any other hundreds of times I'd walked into a room just like this one, and it was different. It was different because I knew I was done. And I knew I could no longer deny that you people had something that was worth having, you know? And the hope came to me that if I just did what you guys did, maybe, just maybe, even I would get what you guys got. And that was enough. That was enough. Being an atheist, being a militant, you know, militant atheist and a fiercely independent intellectual, big deal like me, that was enough for me to get a home group and get a sponsor and just do this thing. Just be willing to do this thing. That was enough.
Back to me. Yeah, for those who are unable to drink moderately, I was just thinking about my last drunk, you know. Remember the last drunk? I don't always remember it, but it just struck me tonight. And that was, I was going to a company party, and I said, I am not drinking tonight. And I knew that my drinking was starting to get off, you know, out of control again. And I was drinking and driving again, and I swore I would never do that again. And I went with this good Christian girl that was my coworker, and she doesn't drink. I mean, she's a normal person, but she could take it or leave it. And we were like, we're going to be buddies tonight. We're not drinking. You're going to protect me, and we're going to be good. And, you know, I went to the place, and everybody's drinking, and they're passing around Coronas. And I was like, I'll just have a beer. And I start drinking the Corona, and I'm like, oh, I hate this. I hate beer. And then I see that they have champagne. I'm like, all right, I'm not going to finish this. So that didn't count. So I'm going to just have a glass of champagne. And I have my glass. And then I see people in the back taking shots of Jaeger. And I was like, oh, I hate Jaeger, but they're having so much fun, you know? So I go to see what they're doing. And all I was supposed to do was go to this event, go to the ceremony, and go home. And by the end of the night, I'm at Hot Tuna somewhere in Virginia Beach with my friend, my Christian buddy, who's also drinking at this point. And I don't smoke cigarettes, so I can't just have one drink. I'm drinking two drinks, and I'm mixing stuff, and I'm black. I don't even remember how I got home. So that was my last drunk, and that was my attempt to, A, not drink at all, and then I was just going to drink moderately. That's what happens to me. Every once in a while, I do have a night where I can pull it off and it like just doesn't work out right and I can't get enough alcohol, so I'm like, damn it, that was a waste of a drink. But that's, when I drink, I need the high and I need to sustain it. I can't just have one or two or three. I'd rather just not drink at all. And then, you know, getting to the point, you know, where I'm realizing how unmanageable my life is, and can I stay sober on my own power? Without a freaking 12-step program and all this psychotherapy and like whatever. And fortunately enough for me, I've tried all that and I've finally proven to myself that I can't. I'm a type of drunk that I need a whole lot of help to keep myself from hurting myself. And you know, I didn't want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. This seems like such a lame place to be, and I was so young, you know, and I'm just like, God, is this really what my life is going to be like? God. And I get here, but it's like, you know, sometimes you just get to a place where you're so beat and you're so out of ideas and options that, you know what? This is a little bit better than what I'm going, you know, what I'm doing for myself right now, so... I was at least open enough to try it and to stop fighting and arguing everything that you guys had to say to me. So I got to the point where I finally knew that I couldn't do it on my own. I couldn't do it on a non-spiritual basis. And I was willing to listen. And I got here and for the second time, the first time and the second time, and I started following direction. But this time I did it with just total... I was, my pride had been leveled big time, which it needed. That really needed to happen for me in order to be open to new ideas and let go of fears of like letting, you know, I was afraid to go through the whole steps, the process and stuff, because I knew you were going to ask me to change. I knew you were going to start asking me to make different choices in my life. And that was hard and scary for me because I didn't know any other way. I didn't know how to get ease and comfort from not using alcohol and other substances and not using men in relationships and not going on shopping sprees. I didn't know how to live my life without using things in that way to provide some kind of relief. And coming here and trying to learn how to live on a spiritual basis is pressuring me and forcing me to be uncomfortable and have these feelings. And like, no, I wanted you to tell me that I was going to come here and like do what you said, and like I would never feel an ounce of pain for the rest of my life. And I learned that that's not the truth. I learned that I get to feel everything. And when I went through the hardest moment of my life was in sobriety this, 2 years now? Yep. to have to face losing somebody I was in a relationship with for 5 years, also an alcoholic and had some other issues, getting a phone call to him shooting himself and telling me he loved me. And not once did I have the desire to drink. During that, I wanted to die. I definitely wanted to die. But I didn't do anything to hurt myself. And I remember being in the worst physical pain, mental agony I've ever had to go through. And having to, how do you deal with that and be sober? And I was talking to my sponsor and I said, can I please have permission to check out on some pills right now? Like, I just want to take something to like a mind eraser. I don't want to have to deal with this reality. And she challenged me and she said, if you do that, I can't tell you what to do, but if you do that, how are you going to know what it feels like to go through something like this when you meet another person who's going through it at that time? You're not gonna be able to say, I know how you feel, because you're gonna check out and take the easier, softer way. And I was like, fuck you, I was so mad. Because she was right. She was right. And my greatest fear when I'm in that kind of place is that it's never gonna end. It's never gonna end. I'm always gonna feel this way. And as long as I keep doing, put one foot in front of the other, keep coming to meetings when I don't feel like coming, keep sharing when I don't feel like sharing, keep picking up the phone and trying to help other women, even when I feel like my life is a total wreck, if I keep doing that, that's the spiritual solution. And that's what starts giving, it rebuilds me on the inside out. And it gives me the strength that I need to face anything. Anything. There is nothing in this world now. Like you said, I always had, well, if I ever get this or if I ever have to face that, I'm freaking quitting. I'm drinking. I don't have no excuses now. None. There is absolutely nothing in this world that I cannot face now and know that I can get through it sober, because I have a spiritual solution. And it doesn't feel good all the time. But that's my greatest asset now. If my life was always freaking peaches and cream and just rosy and perfect. I'm so perfect all the time. You know, I always win. No failure for me. Who can relate to that crap? Nobody. I wouldn't even want to talk to you because I feel like you don't understand me. You know, and I get to have the ups and downs, but I get to do with, you know, we walk shoulder to shoulder. And when I'm down, you guys help me. And when you're down, I help you. And that's, you know, as good as it gets, really. And God, it's so much better than it used to be. If I was still drinking when something like that happened, I don't think I'd be here. There's no way I would have been able to deal with that.
That's our time for this evening. We're going to let Bill Wilson have the last word here. He said, I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way for some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I'd learned about alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help me in those strange mental blank spots. We're going to pass the seven tradition basket. Accordance with the seven tradition that states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seven tradition is essential that every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup central office, local services district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Go. See Kevin for oral.
Hi, Jessica.
Hey, my homebrew dad, my new server, is having a workshop this Saturday. It's a grow workshop with A members, various things of sobriety, sharing their story. It's going to be from 11 to 1, and we are having a potluck. So if y'all want to come out and join us at Edward Command Church.
Is that this Saturday?
This Saturday. Mm-hmm.
11 to 1. Iran. Adam. Any other announcements? All right, the Simple Actions group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting, home group members. And is there anybody in the room tonight that's in their first 30 days of sobriety? We'd just like to welcome you. Could you give us your first name?
My name is Mariah. I'm an
alcoholic. Hi, Mariah. Hi, Mariah. Welcome.
I'm Tara.
Hey, Tara. Tara, welcome.
I'm Mike.
Mike, welcome. Bob, welcome. Anybody else? Anybody in their last 30 days?
No.
All right, sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. Literature is available on that table over there. We got big books and so forth. If you can fold it, it's free. Thank you, Laura, so much for coming and sharing with us tonight. I'd like to thank everyone who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight. All are welcome to attend the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Bella Pizza on Colley Avenue. They have $5 cheese pies. Usually we take over the whole restaurant there and hang out till as late as 10 o'clock. Is anyone inspired to read the last two paragraphs on page 164? Please. Thank you. And let's close. Basically, the chairs need to end up around those tables, eight. Eight at a time.
Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
You don't care, I don't care.
That was fantastic. Yeah, it really was. It was wonderful. Thanks for doing that.